Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hope you all had the chance to check out Tuesday's episode of Josh Steinman, especially the YouTube version, which we recorded in person in Austin. Upping the number of episodes with this high-quality video and audio is thanks to the show's Supercast subscribers. If you'd like to support our growth and expansion, you can go to realignment.supercast.com or click the link in the episode's description / the show notes of your podcast player. You also, in terms of supporting our mission, will also get access to bonus Ask Me Anything episodes and get the chance to ask your questions. Today's episode is with the author Reza Aslan, who has recently released An American Martyr in Persia, The Epic Life and Tragic Death of Howard Baskerville. This is a recording that is incredibly timely, given the increasing protests in Iran. The book is looking at the protests / revolution in Iran in the early 20th century, where an American missionary, Howard Baskerville, the guy in the title, actually was killed in the process of this revolution. He was a person who was very much inspired by the thought of Woodrow Wilson, which gets into a bigger debate America's had about what our role in the world should be. So this conversation is going to look at the past 100 years plus of Iranian protests and revolutions and the relationship that America does and doesn't have to said protests. Hope you all enjoy this episode. And of course, thank you to Lincoln Network and our Supercast subscribers for the support that has gotten us this far.
Reza Aslan, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited about this conversation.
Yeah, I'm really glad to chat with you. You're falling into a trend that I've noticed of late where you'll have an author spend a lot of time on a book, and then the book's themes perfectly fit into the news cycle. That yeah. Theme being obviously the protests in Iran right now. We're recording this a few weeks before the actual release of the book, so I don't want to time gate this too precisely, but can we just start with your broad thoughts on the protests that are happening in the country right now?
What I can say with total confidence is that I have never seen anything like this before in Iran. We'll scratch that. The closest thing that I've ever seen to what's happening right now in Iran was in 1977, which is the start of the 79 revolution. And I say that with the full understanding of the fact that there have been countless protests and uprisings in Iran over the last 40 years. And in fact, the last few months, I mean, yes, Americans are now starting to pay attention to what's happening in Iran because of the scale and the ferocity of the current protests. But Iran has been seeing protests by factory workers and farmers and retirees and pensioners and, people from all walks of life over the last few months, precisely because the economy is on the verge of total collapse. We're talking about a good half the population that lives under the poverty line, 50% inflation rate. The president, Ibrahim Raisi, a few months ago got rid of food subsidies. And so some basic food costs have jumped about 300%. And then what happened with Mahsa Amini was sort of the last straw, if you will. What I think is truly different about what we're seeing right now in Iran and what we saw, for instance, say in 2009, is that in 2009, you had mostly peaceful demonstrations and marches because of a stolen election. And whatever you want to say about the Green Movement, it never really managed to get too far beyond the major cities like Tehran. And it never really managed to pull in anyone other than sort of young, middle class, lower middle class kids, students. What we're seeing right now is a nationwide uprising. There have been not marches, not demonstrations, but violent uprising taking place in at least 19 of the 31 provinces in Iran. So the majority of the provinces. We are seeing men and women, poor and rich and middle class, older, younger, conservatives, progressives, supporters of the regime, frankly, have been coming out and saying enough is enough. Whatever happens, you know, only God knows, obviously. But what I can say as someone who lived through a revolution in Iran and has been watching that country for the last four decades is that this is unlike anything that I have ever seen before. And that I think people should also recognize that although we are desperate for some kind of dramatic, you know, revolutionary moment where everything suddenly changes, that's not likely. That more likely is that this is a marathon, not a sprint, that these protests are going to continue. They're going to bring in more and more people. Now you're seeing the oil sector saying that they're going to go on strike if the crackdown on protesters doesn't stop. At a time in which already, like I said, the economy is in shambles. And one thing that I don't think is talked about enough, and it might be a little bit inside baseball, but I think is probably the single most significant factor in the success or failure of the current revolution, is that the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, is a very, very ill man and could die at any minute, honestly. I mean, really. And there's been a lot of talk in Iran about how he has been grooming his son, Mojtaba Khamenei, to take over his position, which is, the position itself is absurd, right? The role of supreme leader is a joke. It's just something that Ayatollah Khomeini, the man who invented the position for himself, came up out of whole cloth. It has no.
What do you mean by a joke? Do you mean from a legitimacy perspective? From a response? Like, what does that mean?
So, Shiism, which is the majority religion in Iran, is a messianic religion, like Christianity. It believes that one day a promised restorer, in the case of Shiism, he's known as the Mahdi, a messianic figure, will return to earth and create the perfect society and implant justice on the earth. And that until that time, all other governments are temporary and illegitimate. And as a result, that has led to 14 centuries of the Shia clergy essentially sort of separating themselves from politics. You know, Shiism is a political quietist religion. What Khomeini did in creating this position of the supreme leader in Iran is he had, frankly, an unprecedented interpretation of what I just told you, this messianic notion. One that might be familiar to some of your audiences who are familiar with sort of Christian millenarianism, because it's the Islamic version of that, which is rather than sit around, divorce ourselves from politics, waiting for the Mahdi to arrive and create the perfect society, why don't we create the perfect society and then the Mahdi will arrive? And who better to create that society than the representatives of the Mahdi? The Ayatollahs, but not all the Ayatollahs, because Shiism is a profoundly, you know, it's a very diverse religion with lots of different viewpoints and ideas, very much like Judaism, right? One rabbi and another rabbi can have two vastly different ideas, and no, there's no mechanism to say which rabbi is right. You just choose whichever one you like. That's what Islam is like too. Khomeini's innovation was not only should the clergy be in charge of society to make it perfect, but one clergy member, one person should be in charge. And not only should that one person be in charge, the highest religious authority is what he said, but that one person should have the same infallible authority as the Mahdi. This was absolutely heretical. No one had ever said anything like this before. No one had ever thought anything like this before in 14 centuries of Shia thought. But, you know, in post-revolutionary Iran in 1979, Khomeini's voice was the loudest, and he managed to silence all the other, you know, religious voices who were basically calling this idea the craziest thing they'd ever heard. And he made himself the supreme leader, despite the fact that he wasn't the highest religious authority in Iran, far from it. But, you know, he's Khomeini and he can do whatever he wants to. But then when Khomeini died, at first he had picked the highest religious authority, a man by the name of Grand Ayatollah Ali Montazeri, to be his successor. And Grand Ayatollah Ali Montazeri said, if you pick me as a successor, my first act will be to dismantle this entire thing because it's heretical and absurd. And so Khomeini, as you can imagine, changed his mind and picked this absolutely like mid-level cleric, not even an Ayatollah, let alone the highest religious authority, named Ali Khamenei, who was unanimously approved because, you know, he's the second guy. He's not going to rock the boat. He'll do whatever we tell him to do. And now that man, that second supreme leader, the person who holds this, again, totally made up and clearly heretical title, is about to die. And regardless of who becomes the third supreme leader, it's going to completely water down that position anyway. But the fact that he thinks he's going to have his son, who is a low-level cleric, I mean, way down the hierarchy, the religious hierarchy, replace him, essentially is the Iranian government saying, you know what, we're just the Shahs now. That's the same thing. You know, like this whole thing was to make up for, you know, a hereditary, you know, monarch that has no, you know, responsibilities to people whatsoever and absolute authority. And now that's what this is all has become. The supreme leader is now just another word for Shah. If that happens in the midst of these protests, well, then all bets are off. Already, these young people who are protesting on the streets, already one of the most popular chants that we're hearing from them is Mojtaba, Mojtaba, we will die before we see you as leader. Already. So if by chance, you know, Khamenei dies in the next, you know, few months while these protests are going, I think that's the spark that might make the entire thing crumble. So, you know, we're all watching, we're all wondering what's going to happen. But I think you can say with a lot of confidence that this is unprecedented, what's happening in Iran.
That's fascinating. Something that I think will take us a bit to the book that I'm curious about is, we're going all the way into the first decade of the 20th century. And it seems like, other than France, I can't really think of another example of a country and nation where protest revolution has been so intertwined into the story. Like, why, starting with Baskerville's time, can we tell a story of Iran through revolutions and protests? Why is it so central?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, most people are probably unaware of the fact that Iran has had three massive, major, nationwide revolutions in the 20th century. Obviously, we remember the 1979 revolution, which brought down the monarchy and replaced it ultimately with the Islamic Republic, what we see today. In 1953, there was another democratic uprising. It's called the Nationalist Revolution, in which an elected prime minister by the name of Mohammad Mossadegh took over the government. Iranians took to the streets, kicked the Shah out. But of course, that revolution came to a swift end when the CIA showed up to Iran with a suitcase full of cash, led by Kermit Roosevelt, in what is now famously known as Operation Ajax, in which they created a fake counter-revolution, removed Mossadegh from power, and brought the Shah back in. And then, of course, the first revolution, which is the backdrop for this book, which is 1906 revolution, the constitutional revolution, which also happened to be the first democratic revolution in the Middle East, a revolution that resulted in a constitution and a parliament, and for a very, very brief time, turned Iran into a constitutional monarchy. But I think what's pivotal about that 1906 revolution is that while, you know, ultimately it failed to transform Iran in any permanent way, it really set the framework for the exercise of people power in Iran. It was sort of the first time in which the people realized the strength, the power that they have to make their will known, especially when they create these coalitions. The coalition between the sort of the young activist revolutionaries, the clerical establishment, which was on the side of the revolutionaries in all three of those revolutions I mentioned, and the business interests, the merchants. When those three get together, that's when Iran is transformed, for better or worse, but that's when the transformation takes place. And I just find it both sad and ironic that the very same issues that Howard Baskerville, you know, was fighting alongside Iranians for in 1906, the right to have a say in the decisions that rule your life, right? The ability to have, you know, a freedom of conscience and thought and belief and speech are the same exact issues that here we are, what, 116 years later, that are still being fought for in Iran. So, you know, that's depressing, I have to say, as an Iranian, but it does create a lot of resonance, as you say, about this book. I kind of sometimes think about this book and the story that it tells is kind of the prelude for the revolution that we're now seeing once again in Iran.
So let's talk about Howard Baskerville himself then. Like, who was he? Why do you compare him to Lafayette, obviously the Frenchman who helps the U.S. Win its independence from Great Britain? Like, introduce him, and then we'll get into the ideas side of what makes him so interesting.
Yeah. So Howard Baskerville was a 22-year-old Christian missionary from Nebraska, who in 1907 is assigned to go to Persia in order to teach English at a missionary school and to preach the gospel. It's funny, he did not want to go to Persia. You know, in his missionary application, he makes it very clear that he thinks that, you know, God is calling him to promote his kingdom in China or Japan. I think that primarily has to do with the fact that he's reading all these wonderful missionary reports about how great everything is in China and how many, you know, thousands of people are coming to Christ. And he's reading these missionary reports about how beautiful Japan is, that it's sort of, you know, it has the temperament of the British Isles and it's gorgeous and the people are kind. And then alongside that, he's reading these missionary reports from Persia that is basically saying, this is the worst place on earth. Mm-hmm. The Persians are awful. You know, the solid wall of Mohammedanism is unbreakable. And so despite the fact that he, you know, begs to be sent anywhere in the Far East, he gets this unenviable missionary post in Persia. And when he shows up in 1907, he's assigned to the city of Tabriz in the northwest of the country. First of all, he finds out that everything that he was told was a lie. He absolutely falls in love with the country, falls in love with the culture, you know, becomes obsessed with Persian food, loves his students, very quickly becomes the most popular teacher in the school. He's also the youngest teacher in the school, so I'm sure that helped a little bit. You know, he's horseback riding and he's boxing and, you know, he's having the time of his life. But at the same time, he's arrived in the middle of the Persian constitutional revolution, this revolution to turn Iran from an absolute dictatorship to a constitutional monarchy. And he shows up, you know, just around the time in which the previous Shah, the Shah who actually signed that constitution and allowed for a parliament to be elected, dies. And that the Shah's son, a man by the name of Muhammad Ali, becomes the new Shah. And he immediately launches a war against the revolution. He tears up the constitution. He rolls his Russian-made cannons to the parliament building and then destroys the building with the parliamentarians inside. And he uses his Russian-trained troops to regain control over the entirety of the country, except for Tebriz, the city in which Baskerville is now teaching, preaching, and living. And this city, Tebriz, becomes essentially the center, the last bastion of this revolution, which is at this point, you know, more a civil war than anything else between the Shah's troops and these revolutionaries. And for a good year and a half or so, Baskerville manages to keep his head down, you know, mind his own business. He's repeatedly told by the mission that he's there to save souls, not lives, that this is not his problem or his business. He is repeatedly told by the State Department that the U.S. government can play no role whatsoever in this revolution, because as a State Department memo says, quote, Islam implies autocracy. And so therefore, this revolution has no chance of succeeding. There's no such thing as Muslim democracy. So there's no way either the U.S. government or any American can support this conflict. And so he tries his best to ignore what is happening outside of his window, but he can't. He becomes gradually more and more involved in the politics of it. And then at a certain point, the Shah, unable to conquer Tebriz, changes tactics and creates a blockade of Tebriz instead and slowly starves the population to death. And it's in the midst of that horrific humanitarian crisis, as men, women, and children are just, you know, dying on the streets of Tebriz, that Baskerville becomes activated. He just can't ignore the suffering any longer. And despite, again, repeated warnings from the church and from the U.S. government, he quits his job as a teacher. He leaves his post as a missionary. He ultimately abandons his American citizenship and he joins the revolution in order to free the city from the tyranny of the Shah. And, you know, as the subtitle.
Yeah, I was going to say, no danger, gives spoiler. It away.
Yeah, it's not a spoiler. He dies in that fight, but his death becomes a real rallying cry for the revolutionaries. They ultimately do manage to break the blockade and they march all the way from Tebriz to Tehran and fling the Shah off of his throne, send him into exile, re-establish the constitution, rebuild the parliament. They have new elections. And the very first legislative act of that new parliament is to declare this young, you know, evangelical Christian missionary from the Midwest of the United States to be a hero and a martyr in the cause of freedom in Iran. And that's what he remained for really generations, really right up until 1979. Most Iranians knew who Howard Baskerville was. He was a prominent historical figure. I mean, there were, as I say in the book, when I was a kid in Iran, there were schools named after him. There are actually still to this day a couple of streets in Tehran that are named Baskerville. There's coffee shops, you know, called Howard Baskerville, despite the fact that 9 out of 10 Iranians, certainly anyone under the age of 50, has probably never heard of him anymore. His name has really been wiped from the collective memory of Iranians since the 79 revolution. But of course, despite the fact that his name was wiped from memory in Iran, his name was never in memory in America. This is literally the first biography ever written about this incredibly heroic figure who deserves to be known.
Yeah, it's interesting the way if we're taught about Iran's history at all in, you know, high school or something, it will start in 1953. Maybe there'll be a reference to conferences during World War II, but it really just starts 1940 onwards. You're not really learning about 1906. Something that I'd love to reflect on, because I think this is where this gets really complicated, especially let's say reading or writing this book now versus let's say in 2003, is just like the Woodrow Wilson aspect of this. So something you've spoken about, you did a good Publishers Weekly interview, is the relationship between Baskerville's engagement with Wilsonian thought pre-World War II. Obviously, like Woodrow Wilson mm-hmm. is an acclaimed scholar, president of Princeton. Talk about that angle of things.
Yeah, so Woodrow Wilson was, while Baskerville was getting his degree in Christian ministry at Princeton, he arrived in 1903, which was, I think, I want to say a year before Woodrow Wilson had become the president of Princeton. He'd been professor of politics for many, many years, the most popular professor at Princeton. But when he becomes president of Princeton University, he, you know, enacts this kind of absolute educational revolution, the ripples of which I think most university students in America, just whether they know it or not, have benefited from. I mean, I always kind of joke that if you took electives in college, you should thank Woodrow Wilson for it, because he pretty much created the whole concept of electives, you know, courses that you have to take that are not in your chosen field of study. And instituting that process at Princeton is how Baskerville got to know him, because after 2 years of burying his nose in the Bible and studying all the things that you have to do to get a degree in Christian ministry, his junior year, he had to take electives. And so he takes two electives with Woodrow Wilson, and those electives are in jurisprudence and in government. And as you rightly say, you know, Woodrow Wilson is correctly celebrated for essentially birthing what we now know as international law. You know, his conception of an international world order, which obviously culminates in the creation of the League of Nations, the precursor to the United Nations, and his leadership in winning the First World War, all of these things are remarkable. I mean, he had an expansive view of freedom and democracy as something that was the birthright of all peoples everywhere. You know, he really truly believed that democracy was a divine gift, and that every person everywhere has the sort of God-given duty to fight for freedom, and that it's the responsibility of Americans, by the way. That was his big message. It's the responsibility of Americans to make sure that that call for freedom around the world is answered. And yet, you can't talk about Woodrow Wilson without acknowledging that he went to his grave and a despicable, unrepentant racist. I mean, this is a man who, long after the Civil War was done, was an avid supporter of the Confederacy. His family owned slaves. Not like his, you know, grandfather, you know, but he grew up owning slaves. And, you know, he as president of Princeton, he refused to follow the example of the rest of the Ivy Leagues and allow admission to Black students. And when asked why, his answer was because it would be embarrassing to them and to Princeton. You know, this is a guy who, you know, he actually screamed "Birth of a Nation" at the White House. He is to this day credited with essentially ridding all of Washington, D.C., the entire federal government, of its Black workforce when he became president. And so it's hard to reconcile. You know, he's a complicated man. You know, on the one hand, sort of like lofty idealism about the rights and privileges of all human beings. And on the other hand, just an outright, explicit racist against Black people. But he did have this outsized influence on Howard Baskerville. Those two classes that he took with him absolutely changed Baskerville's life. It's why, when he graduated from Princeton, rather than go back to South Dakota where his family was and do what his father and grandfather did, which was become a country preacher, he decided, at least for a little while, he's going to go out into the world. And he's going to go out there with this kind of Wilsonian idea of the fusing of religion and politics. And I'm sure that you know, as he's walking around Tabriz, witnessing with his own eyes a revolution that he had only read about in history books, right? Seeing in practice what Wilson had talked about in theory, that those words were echoing in his head and had a huge part to play with why he made this incredibly fateful decision to abandon everything and join the revolution on behalf of a cause that wasn't his and a people that he barely knew and a country that, you know, wasn't his.
You know, when you tell the story of Woodrow Wilson that way, you bring to mind the fact that he seems to be the perfect example of middle ground we could find when it comes to reassessing American political figures. Founding fathers own slaves. A lot of people own slaves. Therefore, do you judge people by the standards of the time? But Woodrow Wilson was out of step with the time. Absolutely. This is the time where Theodore Roosevelt was inviting a black man to dine in the White House. This is the time when, to your point, other Ivy Leagues are letting black people enroll. The fact that he was out of step, even when judged by the standards of the 1900s, I think that's what places him like just unabashedly on the side of, okay, it's fair to cancel this person, really aggressively. I think a follow-up question I want to ask you, though, and this is what I'm interested in when it comes to Woodrow Wilson's thought. Everything you're articulating when you're referencing democracy, human rights, if we were to have this conversation, let's say during the 1990s or even 2002, that conversation would, especially in the context of the Middle East, would be on a totally different valence than post-Iraq, that version of the conversation, especially when once it's revealed that Iraq doesn't have weapons of mass destruction, the Bush administration, and explicitly in President Bush's second inaugural address, pivots the case for the war on terror to this very explicitly Wilsonian, quasi-evangelical, U.S. has the responsibility to make the world safe for democracy, beyond even the sense that FDR would frame that during World War II. So can you reckon with having this conversation now? It seems like Howard Baskerville is like the best case scenario. If we're talking about these ideas, it seems that 2006, George W. Bush speeches are the worst case scenario.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because you're right. Iraq changed everything. I mean, I remember the conversations that we were having about the importance of democracy promotion, you know, in the world. And Iraq changed everything, not just because it turned out that that war was fought under false pretenses, perhaps even fabricated pretenses, but also because it put lie to the notion that American foreign policy is predicated upon the rights and privileges of people around the world. That's nonsense. And everybody knows that American foreign policy is predicated on American national interests and nothing else, literally nothing else. And so one thing that we have known for, you know, really since the 60s and 70s is that democracy is in other countries is not good for America, that it becomes very difficult to control populations. It's funny that you mentioned Iraq. Let's go back to 2002, because I mean, it's hard to remember that so much has happened in the last 20 years. But if you recall, the countries that supported the war in Iraq, and what I mean by supported is actually gave us airspace and, you know, land space in order to effectively launched that invasion were countries like, you know, Saudi Arabia or the UAE, you know, autocratic regimes. The one country that said no was Turkey. Why? Because Turkey's a democracy. And so they had to vote and they voted no. And all of a sudden you understand, oh, you know, maybe democracy isn't that great when it comes to American national interests. I think the difference, of course, is that there's sort of U.S. government policy and interests on one hand, and then there is the actual legitimate thirst and desire for freedom and popular sovereignty on the other. And There are some very basic things that the American government can do when it comes to promoting the rights of those individuals that has nothing to do, certainly with invasion, but has nothing to do with even America's policy interests. There are economic incentives that we can give. I mean, let's take a look at what's happening in Iran. Part of the problem is that four decades of sanctions, isolation, and containment has created a situation whereby the Iranian people have no choice but to rely on the tyrants that rule them for their most basic needs. And so why is it that revolutions haven't, until right now, and hopefully this one will, haven't managed to really change the situation? Because changing the situation means you may not have bread tomorrow. I think that, again, to your point, there's a difference between an individual who says that in the name of what it means to be American, frankly, in the name of what it means to be Christian, I am going to fight for the rights of other people. And the American government setting its foreign policy interests based on this kind of idea that what we really want to do is promote democracy. By the way, you know, we're talking 20 years ago. Today, the situation is far more ridiculous and frankly macabre, right? Like, I mean, nowadays, if you talk about democracy promotion anywhere in the world, you get laughed out of the room. You know, we're not all that fond of democracy in America right now. There are large swaths of the American public that aren't, you know, so all that supportive about democracy, even here in the United States, let alone elsewhere. And so really what Baskerville does is he forces us to look at ourselves and say, what do we actually believe? I mean, are these universal rights or not? And if they are universal rights, what are we willing to do to make sure that people everywhere have access to the same rights and privileges that we take for granted here in the United States? What is our obligation to the stranger, if you will? Those are questions that have always animated me, you know, mm-hmm. existentially. And there are questions that Baskerville forces us to confront.
You know, it's interesting, then that kind of takes us to two central conflict hotspots. So you always have China and Taiwan in the Asia Pacific, and then you have Ukraine. What makes both those countries slash territories in the case of Taiwan interesting is there's a very national interest based focus you can make on it. So you could say, mm-hmm. well, the reason why we need to back Ukraine is because we don't want Russia to own the breadbasket of Europe. We need to protect our allies who we have treaties with. In the case of Taiwan, you could talk about semiconductors and microchips. You don't have to even
start military bases.
And military, you don't have to talk about Japan. Yeah, exactly. Philippines. You don't have to start with democracy. But I do think in both cases, the democracy part is actually important. I think deeply for on a personal level, the case there, but also I think it speaks to the part of a kind of the global debate you're having right now. How would you reflect upon like the way I just articulated that?
No, I think that's beautifully put. And, you know, we obviously have a very selective idea of, you know, who we support and who we don't support. So yes, democracy in Taiwan, because it serves our interests. Yes, democracy in Ukraine, because it serves our interests. Democracy in Palestine? No, not really. Does not serve our interests to allow those people to have a say in, you know, the kind of government that they're going to have. It's hard. I think because of that, it's hard to ignore, you know, the hypocrisy behind the way that we selectively decide which democratic movements we are going to support and which we don't. But again, I think, forget about that. This is a question for us Americans as individuals, not as a nation, not as a government. Because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be. You know, Baskerville was willing to sacrifice his life for the freedom of other people.
that's not what we're talking about, right? But we are talking about empathy and sympathy and interest and focus. Those things are valuable as well. And where are we putting our empathy and our focus? It's easy to empathize with the Ukrainians, frankly. Why is it so hard to empathize with the Palestinians? You know?
I think the question then, though, would be, what is a government supposed to do with, I think, the tension you're exposing? So something you've also written about is the fact that, you know, the United States, like as a country, as a people, is actually very popular with the Iranian people.
Absolutely.
However, the Iranian government, as it's constituted, is like quite literally, and I think justifiably articulated as like our enemy. They are backing Russia and Ukraine. They obviously played a very interesting role in Iraq post 2004. All those different things you could articulate, the conflict in Syria. What do we do with the notion that people and government are separate, right? Like if you're a policymaker listening to this, what are you supposed to do with that reality?
Yeah, you know, we used to make that whole joke about how jazz won the Cold War, or like rock and roll, like won the Cold War.
Rock and roll.
Exactly. And I don't know why we have forgotten about the importance of soft power. You know, I am severely critical of American foreign policy towards Iran, not because I think that the Iranian government is not a force for bad in the world. It is unquestionably a force for bad in the world. There's no question that America and Iran, in most cases, have conflicting national security interests, certainly in that region. But what is it that we want to do? Are we trying to punish the Iranian government, or are we trying to empower the Iranian population? Because those are different things. And right now we have this kind of maximum pressure policy that has resulted in profound suffering for the Iranian people, but has only further entrenched, you know, the regime in power. As I said before, you know, I make this comment in the book about how a tyrant stays in power by isolating his people, and we have done the tyrant's work for him when it comes to Iran. But there are a number of issues that don't make any sense. For instance, the sanctions that we have put on social media, internet access, those kinds of things. I mean, if you want true change, let's say your goal is regime change in Iran. Let's say that's your goal. Okay. For 40 years, you've tried to create regime change by sanctioning and isolating and containing, and nothing has happened at all. But instead, what you've done is you've disempowered the population to actually have the kind of access they need to the free marketplace of ideas necessary to actually truly have the ability to rise up and change their government. Let's talk about the WTO. I mean, again, I can think of a million examples, but I'm just throw another thing out that shows how ridiculous this is. Iran has been for a decade and a half desperate to join the World Trade Organization. And for a decade and a half, the United States has vetoed the possibility of doing that, as a way of, again, punishing the government for its bad behavior. You want to punish the government for its bad behavior? Allow it to join the WTO, because membership in the World Trade Organization requires a certain level of commitment to standards, standards of economic policy, openness to free markets, the sort of healthy competition, no monopolies, all of that stuff. If Iran is forced to do, will necessarily open up the country even more, empower the population even more. So you're not punishing the government by refusing to allow it to join the WTO. And by the way, this is the other thing about the WTO, is that if you violate those things, then you can be kicked out. The problem with our foreign policy with Iran right now is that there is no carrot. You know, Iran has no incentive to change its behavior because there's nothing we can take away from Iran anymore, right? But let's say, they're part of the WTO. The threat that, hey, if you do not lay off the population right now that is begging for its most basic rights, then we'll throw you out of the WTO. Now, that's a threat, right? That's actually a reason for Iran to moderate its behavior. But what incentive does the government have right now to moderate its behavior? What, more sanctions? You know, it's just, it's a foolish, foolish policy predicated not on changing Iran, which is what is everyone's goal, but on just punishing it for its, you know, bad acts. Well, that hasn't gotten us anywhere in 40 something years. And I don't see it, you know, changing if we continue that policy.
So two things. So firstly, I'd love to hear your response to, because I know audience members who are like more China hawkish are going to be screaming this. They would say, well, look, Reza, I get what you're saying, but we let China into the WTO in the 2000s under many of the same articulations you made. Mm-hmm. And it just turns out that regime type matters. When you have a Chinese Communist Party, when you have an Ayatollah, at the end of the day, it's just possible that you'll end up empowering the regime with these resources, but you won't get the possibility of democratic change that you're describing here. So I'm curious how you would respond to that counter.
Yes, and I've heard that argument before, and it's a valid argument. But what I will say this is that if you look at the history of the 20th century, what you can say with some measure of confidence is that a country, when it has some form of representative government plus access to the free market economy, often what that equals is some kind of national success. China has access to the free market economy, but it has nothing even resembling a representative government. There's no representative government of any kind in China. So access to the free market economy, all it did was further enrich and empower the oligarchy that controls that country. Iran is far more complicated than that. Iran has two governments. Yeah, it has, of course, it's like a split government, and some people understand this. It has a representative government, an elected president, an elected parliament that like debates laws, an independent independent, that's the wrong term for it, a judiciary. A judiciary that interprets those laws, and a robust political culture, right? That on off years get 60% participation in elections. Now, of course, as all Iran watchers will say is, yeah, but that representative government has on top of it this unrepresented government, which is the supreme leader that we had talked about, who is the commander in chief of the military, who can veto any law that parliament passes, who can dismiss the president at his whim, who can put aside any judgment made by the judiciary. All of that is correct. But at the very least, Iran has had 4.5 decades of an experience of representative government and has on occasion really used that access to representation to make significant changes in Iran, whether it's the Khatami years or the Rouhani years, whatever the case may be, and of course in the legislature as well. What it doesn't have is the other end of it. Mm-hmm. So in other words, it's like the opposite of the China argument, right? China got free market economy, but it never had a representative government. Iran does have a tradition of a representative government that can occasionally enforce its will, even on the clerical regime, frankly, but it has no access to the free market economy. I don't want to be glib about this, but revolutions are fought and won by the middle class, not by the poor, you know? And right now, there's hardly a middle class to speak of in Iran. I mean, you know, certainly not in the sense of a leisure class. There's no leisure class in Iran. Again, half the population is under the poverty line. being middle class means you've got four jobs. It takes a moment like we're seeing now, a moment of absolute despair and desperation to get people out onto the streets. But I understand all the arguments against it, but I do think that the Iran situation provides precisely the framework necessary to see how the mobilization of a middle class, access to the rest of the world, a interdependent trade relationship that then can be used to enforce proper behavior on the global stage. All of those things can work in Iran in a way that they don't necessarily need to work in a behemoth like China.
Yeah, I love that response from you, just because it helps you just sort of get at, in a way, kind of the critique you could make of the free market China articulation in the 1990s, and that free markets are not just, you know, manna from heaven or seedlings right. that you could just drop onto things. And all of a sudden everything. You have yeah. village councils, and then it's democratic China and everything's good to go. No offense, Thomas Friedman. But basically, you know, I think that the last two questions I want to have here is, one, if I'm hearing what you're saying, if I were to articulate what a more hawkish person on Iran would say to your point about punishing the regime, choking the country, it would basically be that, let's assume this person's operating in good faith. Look, as a post-Arab Spring, I am incredibly skeptical that democratic change, revolutions, etc., will either abound in the name of democracy, look at, you know, Egypt, or to U.S. national interest. We would be giving up both. Sorry, we'd be making a gamble in two things that wouldn't actually come about. How should folks who are suffering a hangover, not merely from the Iraq war, but from the dashed optimism of 2011, how should they think of what you're describing?
I don't think that we should ignore the role that the United States played in the dashed optimism of 2011 or in Iran in 2009. I think that especially when you look at, like, let's use the example of the JCPOA, the so-called Iran nuclear deal. Hassan Rouhani, the previous president of Iran, and you can, whatever you want to say about him, okay, he's a cleric and he was sort of, you know, one of a handful of vetted candidates, but he represented a vision of Iran that was far more in alignment with what we in the United States want to see out of Iran. And he had an enormous amount of popular support. And he did unquestionably and explicitly make certain promises about social norms and behaviors. It's precisely what we're seeing now is because during the Rouhani years, the morality police more or less went away, you know? And now with Ibrahim Raisi, this absolutely hard-line, frankly, a man who belongs in the ICC, not, you know, in the president's office in Iran, he's the one who has redoubled the focus of on the morality police, et cetera, leading to these revolutions, et cetera. But what Rouhani basically said was, vote for me and I will get this nuclear deal in place. And I will open up the country and you'll have jobs again and you'll be able to feed your family again. You'll be able to get on the internet again. And yes, I support the regime. I am a supporter of the status quo insofar as what the government is. But, you know, I'm going to give the people the power mm-hmm. necessary to actually have some of their more basic needs met. And then We changed presidents and we basically told Rouhani, hey, never mind. You know, all that you did, all that you said, everything that you risked, the promises that you made and the promises that were believed was all BS. And that was the moment, I think, in which what we saw, you know, what basically what we're seeing right now is that the government switched from openness, possibility of reform, the possibility of interdependence in some way, to a government that is completely closed off now, further right than it has been in at least two generations, and a population that is suffering profoundly for believing, you know, American promises about a possibility of a different kind of relationship. So it all goes back to where this conversation started. We can't talk about the behavior of governments like Iran without looking at ourselves and the actions that we have done to precipitate, you know, some of the negative consequences that we are seeing right now. You know, will that change anytime soon? Probably not. I think when it comes to Iran policy, it doesn't matter whether it's Democrat or Republican, it seems like we are more or less stuck in place right now. And so the onus is on the Iranian people. For generations, they've been willing to sacrifice themselves in order to change that country. And for generations, we haven't been much help. And so I don't know. I mean, maybe, look, I get that it's a little bit Pollyannish to think that maybe a book about Howard Baskerville could change things. But I will say this, that, you know, this kid, this Christian kid from Nebraska, was someone who was willing to put his faith into practice, put his beliefs into action. You know, near the end of his life, the consul general in Tabriz, the American consul general, tried one last time to dissuade Baskerville from his current course of action. And he says to him, you know, on the battlefield, this is not your fight. You're American. These people are Persian. This is not your country. This is not your fight. And Baskerville very famously says, the only difference between me and these people is the country of my birth, and that is not a very big difference. I just wish that as Americans, we could remember that, right? That there isn't that much that separates us, you know, from Iranians, except that we were born here and they were born there. But our wishes and our hopes and our desires, our dreams, our aspirations, our struggles, you know, our rights are, you know, to quote Woodrow Wilson, our God-given rights are the same. And so what are you going to do about that? Does that matter to you? Is it important? Or is it just something to ignore and, you know, go back to seeing what, like, you know, Ben Affleck and J-Lo are up to?
You know, we'll close there, but I think given I think I better understand what you're really saying here after hearing that last anecdote, because the interesting, and this is why Howard's a good person to profile, is the question is, what do you, like, as an individual American citizen, think about that? Because obviously the US government on 15 different levels cannot treat an Iranian the same way as they treat an American. Like, that's right. A basic thing. But at a deeply personal level, I think bringing that perspective there and seeing it through Howard's eyes is an interesting way to think about the challenges we're facing. So Reza, this has been really great. Would love for you, just because we're closing the episode, to shout out the book specifically, the title, give the spoiler, but what happens, obviously, but then we'll close out there.
Yes. So the book is called An American Martyr in Persia, The Epic Life and Tragic Death of Howard Baskerville. It's actually the first biography ever written about Howard Baskerville. And it's a story that not just has a lot of historical resonance, as we've discussed, but I do think that it's the kind of story that Americans especially need to read for the very questions that you were asking. What is our responsibility to people that we don't know, that we don't have a connection to? What are you willing to do to help someone, you know, who doesn't look like you or pray to the same God as you or have the same color as you? That's a question that I think is, you know, at this point right now, probably the most important question we could ask ourselves as human beings.
Reza, thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.